Following the deadly mass shooting at a Florida high school, there's lots of attention on school safety. The number of gun incidents in Hawaii schools has actually dropped since 2010. And last year, there were 21 incidents, all involving air guns, and most were at middle schools. Joining us live is Dan Carlson, the Assistant Superintendent of Facilities and Support. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Glad to be here.
So what can you share with us? We know that in the recent weeks, we've had incidents involving threats at Moanalua, Kapolei, and what was the other one? The third?
Mililani.
Mililani, yep. Yeah. So explain what are the procedures that people are supposed to follow when there is a threat?
Well, we have a number of different procedures, and each school has an emergency action plan, if you will, for the different situations. These situations that happened recently, again, we can attest a lot of that to kind of a copycat kind of situation, which is very unfortunate. When something does happen on the national level, we oftentimes will see that kind of stuff repeated, or even at the local level repeated. Those are very unfortunate. Those situations, though, were all handled, again, in accordance with their emergency action plans. And, again, we have a number of different things that we do follow. We provide that guidance as a – from the state level, we provide the guidance as far as how to deal with those. We also offer to have our security and experts go out to the different schools and help them assess their campus so that they have a plan. So as they're developing these emergency action plans, that they have some guidance. Those plans are actually reviewed on a yearly basis and updated on a yearly basis, and we monitor that and make sure that again they're doing that and they're following those procedures.
Tick off the list. So if someone is let's say is suspected of bringing a handgun to school or a gun to school, what is the principal supposed to do?
Principals really required to do three different things. So usually they involve the complex area superintendent. They usually involve our communication shop, and then they usually involve our safety, security, emergency preparedness branch. They inform them, and as a group, they can kind of come together with a solution. Oftentimes, again, the communications folks will work on helping the principal develop a letter that would go out to the parents to explain the situation. Our safety, security, emergency preparedness branch is tied in with both HPD and HFD, and again, they've got those ties into those communities. So, again, they work on as a team to kind of come up with what's the best approach to this. Each situation is very different and very unique, but we all again, so from that perspective, we try and make sure we're not doing things at the same time that would foster follow copycat kind of type situations. So again, it's a delicate balance. It's a mix, but it is done as a group and as a team.
Is it mainly the principal that's supposed to call police?
Yes, and that's the first thing that they should do, and that is always the call 911 if a situation is there. That's their best approach. But then from there, if they can make these other calls and inform the other players, so that everybody can be involved.
So we've had the number of cases go down as far as guns are concerned,
right?
And they're all air guns. At least last year,
yep,
they were.
Yep.
Is there a concern that maybe we just might be complacent? Because we've been very fortunate in,
right,
not having a major incident here.
We've been very fortunate, and again, but we don't take that for granted. So again, we continue to each of our schools, for example, is required to do 5 different drills a year. We leave that up to the principal to determine when they're going to accomplish those. But that's anywhere from a lockdown to shelter in place, off-site evacuation, earthquake or tsunami type drills. Where again, they're required to do those. That's in addition to fire drills, and again, fire drills are required at the secondary school level quarterly, but at the elementary school level, again, monthly. So, again, we take all that stuff serious. As far as the actual weapons, like I said, we've been very fortunate, but we don't take that for granted. We've got a very good SSA program, which is basically a security-type person.
SSA is what?
Basically a security assistant. Okay. To the administration, and on the neighbor islands, we're actually fortunate enough to have a partnership with each of the police departments, and at each of the middle schools on our neighbor islands, we actually have a police presence, and he covers that complex area, or that high school and middle school campuses, and develops a relationship with the students there, and a lot of times that person is probably as influential as any counselor. A lot of those police officers develop relationships with these students, and sometimes our students that are acting out are more troublesome. It's a great program. We're very fortunate to have that on the Neighbor Islands, and we have a very good relationship with the police department as well. They frequent our schools, and most of the they've got community relations kind of people that actually tie themselves to a school to help us out.
And I know we've had threats on social media, like the one we saw last week at Cap Ole. I think the FBI got involved.
They do. We've got ties with all the different communities, FBI being one of them. Those things are taken very seriously. And I think if there's one word we can get out there these are serious offenses that kids don't realize they're being kids, but they don't realize just how significant those are. And we take each one of them serious, and we have to do our due diligence, and we do.
A lot of the campuses are pretty much open campuses, and you're supposed to go in and check in with the principal's office. But what do you do in a situation when you're in a lockdown and maybe a parent wants to go get their kid and is banging on the door? What do you do then?
That's a very difficult thing to deal with. And we advise our parents in any kind of these lockdown situations or even the shelter in place, which has recently hit the news with the potential nuclear their best course of action is to not go to the school. We will take care of the kids. We've got great programs. We have that in place. But the worst thing that they could do is potentially show up at the school to be, in a dangerous situation. It's not an easy thing to deal with, and we are clearly relying on our principals and the leadership that they have to make those hard calls.
Right, and many students probably do have access to phones, and while they're not supposed to be using it during class time, they may use an opportunity, if there's an incident that arises, to call mom or dad and say, Mom, come pick me up.
Exactly. Social media, along that same line, is just added another layer of complexity. It's great. It's a great medium. But at the same time, another layer of complexity as far as dealing with some of these situations. But those are all things that, our comm shop is very tied into. They monitor and they keep an eye on that. And, we do what we can to try and utilize that as a plus and hopefully minimize the negative.
Before we run out of time, I do want to bring up the issue of locks on the doors, because there are some lawmakers that say because of Florida's incident that we need to look at getting doors that lock from the inside.
And
what's involved with that?
Yeah, it's a it is. There's a bill out there right now that was it was started well before the Florida situation, and we've acknowledged this issue. Our schools. Average age is 61 years old. We got many buildings that are over 100 years old. They just were not designed with these kind of issues in mind. So we have 12,000 plus classrooms. Each of those probably has two doors or should have two doors on them. We're talking about a lot of doors to modify. We acknowledge and, completely agree with the intent. The issue that we're having right now, and I was in dialogue this weekend even with Senator Gabbard and some of the legislators, just as how do we really do this? The issue is also with the fire department. To be honest, the schools, those doors have to be exitable with one motion. So, the idea of just putting a deadbolt on a door for a lockdown kind of situation, it's not as easy as that. And that's where we just need to have that dialogue really with the fire departments and. With our legislators to kind of come up with a solution there, because it is costly.
Right. So we just don't want a knee-jerk reaction. Think about this very calmly and sensibly.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan Carlson, for joining us today.
Appreciate it.
Dan Carlson is the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Facilities and Support Services in Hawaii's Department of Education.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting Swiss Piano Ensemble Trio Raffaele, 4 p.m. Sunday, March 4th. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we've got the expertise of Christopher Phillips to help us navigate those topics. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week, stargazers look out for our sister planet Venus in the western skies during sunset. A waxing crescent moon this week means a return of dark skies.
And you have news this week about the world's biggest optical telescope going online, but there's a catch.
There is, yes. It came online at the European Southern Observatory in Chile. It is called ESPRESSO, and it has an effective diameter of 16 meters. Its goal will be to discover Earth-like planets and peer into distant quasars in the far reaches of the universe.
When you say it has an effective diameter of 16 meters...
That's because this isn't one single telescope. It is a type of instrument we call an interferometer. An interferometer is an array of telescopes that combine their light to mimic the light-collecting power of a larger telescope. In the case of ESPRESSO, it is combining light from the four large mirrors of the Very Large Telescope in Chile.
And what's one of those things, Ron?
Well, the VLT, as it's known, is composed of four telescopes, each with a mirror of around 8.2 meters.
That means this thing is 32 meters and is bigger than the 30-meter telescope, so that thing has just been outshined already.
It would seem that way, but there is a catch. The catch being that even though you can combine these telescopes together to mimic the effect of a large telescope in terms of its light-collecting power, they don't produce the detail that a large telescope would produce, the high resolution. So the TMT is still very safe if it ever gets built.
Right. Because otherwise, everyone would just be using this if they could get the same resolution, basically, is what you're saying.
They absolutely would if they could get the same resolution. But constructing an interferometer is complex business, especially when you spread them out over a very large area. On Mauna Kea, we have the VLBA, or Very Long Baseline Array, and this is a radio telescope that uses radio dishes spread out across the U.S. from Hawaii all the way to the Virgin Islands, and that mimics the effect of a very large telescope. But this works because they are all built to the same specification.
And so that means we're likely to be hearing some results from this thing soon, and I'm assuming you're going to be sharing them with us here.
Absolutely.
It's Christopher Phillips and another Enlightening Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Architects for the Molokai General Hospital on the island of Molokai. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
On February 24th, HPR's Atherton Studio is the setting for a rare rhythm summit, featuring three of Hawaii's premier musicians, Kenny Endo, Noel Okimoto, and Dean Taba. Get your tickets for this evening of world music and jazz fusion in the Atherton on the 24th at hprtickets.org. Preferred pricing for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Hawaii's people use solar energy more on a per capita basis than the people of any other state. And now that battery storage technology is advancing, solar makes more sense than ever. We asked Marco Mangelsdorf for ProVision Solar, who is the director and secretary of the Hawaii Island Energy Cooperative, what drives solar energy use in our islands.
Well, the drivers, let's look at the drivers first. The drivers is the demand.
Right.
Demand both in terms of mobile power to be able to send cars more than 50, 100 miles and up to 200 to 300 or more miles on a single state of charge to try to alleviate what's popularly known as range anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So Elon Musk, I think, can be seen as the pioneer in terms of pushing the boundaries. I'm not sure what his company is valued at right now, but last year it actually surpassed General Motors, even though for every car that Elon sold, GM sold 85. So the demand for batteries that are able to propel us for hundreds of miles in a single charge.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, renewable energy, since the state is at the forefront, has been for a number of years. In fact, this year is the 10-year anniversary of the Hawaii Clean Energy Initiative, or HCEI, which Connie Lau at Hawaiian Electric Industries and HECO and Hawaiian Electric in general committed to that, along with the state and regulatory agencies, that this was something that we were going to dive into as an Ohana, as a collective, to try to make the state more independent, more self-sufficient, more resilient. So it's really been driven, the development of these technologies has been driven by demands in the marketplace and the need, the felt need, not just by Americans, but also across much of the planet as well, to get away from combusting things to produce electricity. And that I see as, global warming, climate change. Read a piece recently that the oceans are expected to rise a lot faster than some of the smarter people than you and I predicted we were going to have until, let's say, turn of next century. Well, maybe it's going to be 40, 50 years sooner. So I just say overall the demand for battery storage and more applications have really pushed a number of companies and countries. Now, the Chinese, even though Elon Musk and his gigafactory outside of Reno is the biggest one in the world right now, I've looked at a chart recently from Bloomberg that showed another 8 or 9 kind of similar size gigafactories lined up, principally in China and in the Republic of Korea. So it's really a booming, will be an even more booming demand for battery storage that's going to help us get to where we want to be, because there are times when the wind doesn't blow, times when the sun don't shine, that you need to be able to store this electricity for power use.
And that gets to the advantage that it has for the homeowner, for home solar. You can accumulate power during the day and store it all night?
Depending on what your interconnect agreement is with either one of the Hawaiian electric companies, HECO, HELCO, or MECO, or KIUC on Kauai, will dictate whether you actually need storage or how much storage you want to have. So it's still very much kind of a game in flux right now. We're waiting in the industry as well as consumers to see what Hawaiian Electric will be rolling out in less than 10 days. They are going to be submitting to the PUC by the 20th, 6 days from now, the documentation, the language for two new interconnect agreements. One is called the Customer Grid Supply Plus, and the other is called Smart Export. So there's going to be a new range of options, more options than we've ever had before, from which consumers can choose. And that'll dictate whether they want batteries, need batteries, and how much storage, if they do get batteries, how much storage they'll want.
So it sounds as if you wanted to move your home in this direction, your first task would be to check with your local utility.
You can certainly do that, because there is no shortage of information on the Hawaiian Electric website and KIUC website. At the same time, if they are in the market to at least look at the possibility for those who don't have solar electric yet, and they'll kind of put up plug-in for the whole darn state, mm-hmm. in that we are the most solar electrified state in the U.S. on a per capita, per household basis. We're also the most solar water heating promoting state in the country as well. So we really are the solar kings and queens, so to speak, on a per capita basis. And that's to our great credit. And it makes sense, of course, because our island chain is in the middle of this broad, wide Pacific, and the supply lines for fossil fuels coming to our state are literally thousands of miles long. So one of the things that an interested consumer can do is to see who's in town in terms of solar providers and do some research. You can check us out on Yelp. You can check us out with the Better Business Bureau. You can check us out with the Contractors License Board. And, typical good advice is, if you're thinking about making that kind of a capital investment, you should get 2 or 3 bids, do your homework, and you're making a sizable investment.
What I was referring to, Marco, was the whole idea of finding out if you even need storage, the whole idea of assessing your daily usage in those terms.
Well, back in the what we kind of refer to as the good old days of net energy metering, which existed in the state from 2001 until 2015, 14 years, no batteries were needed, really, unless you wanted to have backup power in case the grid goes down. And the grids in the state are typically 99.966 or 998 reliable on a gross basis. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of people who went with net energy metering, and there were about 80,000 of them, did not have a need for batteries on an economic basis. Why? Because whatever power they produced was fed back into the grid. Whatever power they produced that they didn't use was fed back into the grid, and they were credited at the full retail rate of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
The commission, the Public Utilities Commission, brought that to a close October of 2015 because it was an incentive, and I agreed with their decision. It was a subsidy and incentive which did what it was supposed to do. It spurred the market. It brought costs down. It brought about mass adoption. So it was time for it to be phased out. So there was no need for batteries for many, many years. Now that we've got these new programs, plus our utility has what's known as an evening peak. What that means is that, and it makes sense intuitively, people get home from work, get home from school, they start using electricity, they start cooking, they start bathing, they'll start doing laundry. So we have a peak typically from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. That's mm-hmm. when we need the most electricity. Well, that's doesn't correspond very well when the sun, as far as when the right. sun is shining, right? So if there's a means to store the electricity produced during the day when there is less demand and provide it to your home loads and possibly to the utility company when there's the highest demand, that is a driver for more and more storage going in. And that, in fact, is what we're seeing in this new smart export tariff. Allows for feeding back into the grid, but only between 4 p.m. to 9 a.m. the next morning. And in order to do that from 4 p.m. to 9 a.m., you have to store the electricity you produced from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Uh-huh. when the sun is shining.
And that's where the batteries come in.
That's where the batteries come in, correct.
Marco Mangelsdorf of ProVision Solar is a director and secretary of the Hawaii Island Energy Cooperative and has taught energy politics at UH Hilo and the University of California.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000. The new Career Center allows students to explore possible careers, get localized data, and understand expectations for those careers. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Honolulu's police department has operated under a cloud for years as the investigation of its recently ousted chief drags on, and charges of misconduct continue to accumulate. The new chief is taking bold steps to renew public faith in the department and is drawing support from unlikely quarters, as Nick Gruby tells us in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Chief Ballard was tasked with a pretty radical shift in direction, or at least has embarked on one, hasn't she?
Well, yeah. I think Chief Ballard has come into the Honolulu Police Department as chief in a very difficult time for the department. For the past several years, HPD has been under a darkening cloud of suspicion, mostly due to an ongoing FBI investigation into the former chief, Louis mm-hmm. K. Aloha. Now, the U.S. Department of Justice has indicted Louis K. Aloha as well as several other officers for taking part in sort of a wide-ranging conspiracy that stems from the allegations that they had framed a family member of Chief K. Aloha, former Chief K. Aloha, and his wife for the theft of their mailbox.
Right.
And so all of that has sort of colored the selection of Chief Ballard, who's supposed to come in and rebuild community trust.
Well, one of the ways in which she's working to do that, Nick, is the handling of a particular recent case of misconduct, and by immediately turning investigation of that case over to the feds. I'm wondering if her predecessor would have done that.
Well, this is actually a really interesting case, right? So four police officers were accused of forcing a man to lick a urinal in a public restroom. Now, Chief Ballard holds a press conference to address these allegations and says that she stripped the officers of their police duties or police powers and turned the case over to the FBI. That's in addition to HPD doing its own internal affairs investigation. Contrast that with a press conference that
ago when one of his officers was caught on surveillance video taking punches and swings at his girlfriend in a Waipahu restaurant. Right. The officer's name was Darren Cotrola. Louis Kealoha held a press conference also, but instead of addressing the issue, he became defensive and said that he was not going to, quote, cave to political pressure. And it was a lot different tone than the tone set by Chief Ballard.
Well, it was his administration has been described as a kind of a circle the wagons tone with regard to misconduct. And I know the press has had its struggles in getting information from HPD under the previous chief. Is that correct?
That's true. I mean, I think that we have yet to see full-bore transparency with the Honolulu Police Department, but of course, part of that could be due to the transition. But under Chief Kealoha, it was difficult, I can speak from my own experience, getting information out of the department. Often the chief, actually rarely the chief, would grant interviews with the press. Chief Ballard has been a lot different in just her first 4 months on the job and has been more willing to speak about issues, good or bad, involving the department.
Well, Nick, thanks for that. It looks as if there'll be plenty to talk about, and thanks for checking in with us.
All right. Hey, thanks, Chris. Thanks.
That was Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby with today's Reality Check.
Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. It takes a lot to surprise IMF head Christine Lagarde, but it happens.
You know what? There is one thing that totally blew my mind.
Also, how Uber data can make an economist's cold heart sing.
I have had a burning question for almost 15 years, and by using Uber data, I've finally been able to get to the bottom of it.
It's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7.
At this hour, Governor David Ige is set to begin a news conference on Brigadier General Kenneth Hara's report on the missile alert false alarm and the broader issue of emergency preparedness. The governor and General Hara will be joined by Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim as well to talk about an action plan. We are told that Mayor Kim is going to be asked to sit on a committee that will look at possibly implementing this action plan going forward. As we await the start of that news conference, we can review what we know. Joining us in studio is HPR News Director Bill Dorman. Hi, Bill. We did talk with Toby on Friday, and he had addressed the issue of software, that the software that they had used was actually brand new. It only been in place for 1 month.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also in terms of this news conference, you know, up to now we've had a couple. It's been about 3 weeks since we've heard from the FCC and the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency itself. Those were both focused on the false alarm and the missile alert and the false alarm and all of that. This one is going to be a bit broader by description in terms of all hazards preparedness improvement and action plan and report. So two aspects of that. But when you hear action plan, you think money. So there is likely something attached to this in terms of specific steps as well.
Right. And we've been told that the lawmakers were kind of given the heads up that this report will likely mean that they're going to have to come up with some money because really the Department of Emergency Management has been operating with some parameters, but only dealing with storms and earthquakes. But this missile thing is something new.
You know, there's also been a shift in the discussion. Bill, as Catherine, as you recall, on the 13th of January, much of the post alert discussion was about an individual. An individual made a mistake. And then, and it happened live, you came in live during our show 2 weeks later, it was the January 30th report,
right. Was,
you know, again, focused on that individual, had revelations we hadn't heard before about the conduct of that individual. He had been warned repeatedly. Since then, we've heard denials from from his side, the person referred to as employee one. But the discussion since that January 30th report has been more systemic.
Right.
And that seems to be where things are going now.
And it's also a matter of, again, looking at not just meanwhile, you have Senator Schatz putting forth legislation to take the idea of missile alerts away entirely from a state agency to make it to put it under federal guidance rather than state. This news conference today presumably not getting into any of that, but again, taking a broader look at those emergency responses.
And Toby Claremont did mention that part of the reason why they went to this new software is because the previous software was beyond its life. And he'd mentioned that it was taking like 5 minutes to load up. So issues that obviously the department is going to be grappling with going forward and will be mentioned in this news conference.
We're going to go there live now. Governor David Ige from the governor's office.
This action plan is comprehensive and covers the major requests in my executive order. As a result, I consider this to be the final report rather than having a 30-day report and a 60-day report. This report covers both the short-term and broader long-range discussions. This is the beginning of a process. You know, we are committed to having the best emergency management agency that interacts with all levels of government. You know, it's just a reminder again that a missile attack is an act of war, and collaboration with the federal government is essential and required. The report identifies a breakdown in leadership and management at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, and we are actively seeking a new administrator who will build the team that will implement the recommendations that are contained in this report. I just would like to remind everyone that Hawaii is ahead of the game. No one else is talking about or responding to all hazards as the state of Hawaii has done. We expect that we will begin the process and engage everyone necessary. We are identifying gaps and vulnerabilities for handling all hazards so that the residents in our state can be prepared. And with that, I'll turn this over to General Hara, who can summarize the findings in the report.
Thank you, Governor Ige. I'd like to begin by thanking the core team members and the emergency management professionals that contributed to this report. Without their contributions, there's no way we'd be able to produce this report. Core team consisted of seven individuals that selected to create diverse representation. We reviewed current emergency response systems and identified recommendations for improvement. The report is written by and prepared as a roadmap for emergency management planners. It can be used as a guide to help reshape how emergency management is organized and how resources are prioritized and allocated to respond to any hazard efficiently and effectively. The report focuses on preparations required after any disaster, not only the ballistic missile threat. It identifies the need to prepare a strategic plan for the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. Identifies the need to update the state's all-hazards catastrophic plan, which includes publishing a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear annex. It recommends a whole-of-community approach, including all emergency management stakeholders in the planning process to address the gaps and vulnerabilities that exist today. It confirms and agrees with Brigadier General Retired Olivera's investigative reports, all of the findings and recommendations. Other key details include a complete comprehensive annex or plan to address the ballistic missile preparedness threats had not been fully developed prior to the commencement of the missile alert testing and the internal missile alert drills, nor had it conducted a risk assessment. There's a misconception that Governor Ige and other elected officials engage with the Hawaii Emergency Management Agencies, specifically the state warning. commitment of the missile alert testing and the internal missile alert drills, nor had it conducted a risk assessment. There's a misconception that Governor Ige and other elected officials remains with the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, specifically the state warning point. The state warning point's established ballistic missile alert checklist did not have a step to notify. Observations also point to the improper management of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. Senior leadership lacked a strategic plan that provides vision and direction, prioritizes energy and resources, facilitates decision-making, and identifies goals and objectives. Observations also point to the improper management of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. Senior leadership lacked a strategic plan that provides vision and direction, prioritizes energy and resources, facilitates decision-making, and identifies goals and objectives. As part of this process, HAIMA needs to conduct a comprehensive. Other observation recommendations, the need for improvement in technological capability. This is primarily the software that the State Warning Point used to notify the public. As was mentioned in General Oliveira's report, they did not have a system to do a credentialed two-step process to send the message out. So what we're asking to investigate is to see if you can have the first person that initiates the message to have a login and password, and then a second person, more than likely the supervisor at the state warning point, to also be able to log in and password before the message can be sent. It also recommends to enforce current statutes, the Hawaii Revised Statutes 127A and Executive Order, Administrative Directive 15-01 with dealing with emergency management. We just need to review what the requirements are and to verify compliance. I look forward to partnering with the new Hawaii Emergency Management Agency leadership as we improve preparedness for all hazards. Thank you. What the requirements are and to verify compliance. I look forward to partnering with the new Hawaii Emergency Management Agency leadership as we improve preparedness for all hazards. Thank you. Partnering with the new.
We're back in our HPR studio with Catherine Cruz and our news director, Bill Dorman. We've just heard from the from General Hara and from the governor about their latest report on the missile alert. Bill, Catherine, initial impressions?
Well, he said there was a breakdown in leadership. We kind of figured that.
Leadership and management, and that also points to, I mean, it's going to take some time to sort through the specific recommendations of the report itself, but this sounds like it's goals and objectives, comprehensive review, another phrase being used. I think the governor's back at the podium if we have that.
Lead the country. As we take these action steps described in the report, we will become a stronger and more resilient community. As the general had said, Mayor Harry Kim, who I think the people of Hawaii have come to learn and trust as the best in terms of knowledge of disaster preparedness, has been a vital part of the general's team, and I invited him to say a few words here this afternoon.
And I'm not used to formality. I'm standing back there, changing. Everybody looks like, and to speak. And I'm not used to formality. I'm standing back there, changing. Everybody looks like, and to speak, be part of. I really wanted to know if he really wanted me in this. because I will say what I will say. I saw the report, read the report, as I've told them this morning in closed doors.
I'd love to know what we're missing from what Harry Kim is saying right now.
Chris, we should explain to our listeners as well that we are taking a live stream from the State of Hawaii Department of Defense coverage of the governor's news conference along with Harry Kim.
I saw the report, read the report, as I've told him this morning, in closed doors.
Sounds as if we're going to be getting Harry Kim's audio intermittently, but... His very presence at this news conference and his being put forward by Governor Ige is significant, because for a long time, and Catherine, you and I remember back in the days when Kilauea volcano first went off in 1983, that the press came to know and trust Harry Kim when he was the civil defense administrator for Hawaii Island. And he's built a reputation ever since as somebody who can, you know, handles crises like these. I suspect that's a very strong part of why he's there today.
Right, he's a straight shooter. He will tell you what's on his mind. He's not going to mince words either. And I think that's what the public would like to hear. What's his take on it? You know, if he's going to reassure us that things are going to be fine going forward, and what is it going to take in order to make that happen?
You know, that's also an interesting point in terms of, although the governor said that this is the final report in terms of General Hara, it clearly is the start of a longer process, and bringing Harry Kim into this is going to change the complexion of sort of where this goes. At least, Catherine, that would be my assumption.
Right, and, there's discussion about if we do need to make all these changes that are included in this report, and it is going to involve money. Lawmakers have to buy in on it. We were told that the software that they were using was very old, and that under state procurement laws, when they got bids, is that you have to go with the lowest bidder. Mm. But it's not always maybe the best operating system that we should have in place. And so, you know, I think maybe some of these things that will be addressed in this report will have to be taken to heart by lawmakers. If we want a good system, we might have to pay for it.
And that software was singled out in as a specific mention in the report from General Hara. I think that Governor Ige is responding to some questions, if we're able to bring that to you.
I just would like to remind you that over the last 24 months, North Korea has launched 35 missiles. Each missile is getting better. At the same time, they've exploded a nuclear device, which has 10 times more powerful than the previous devices. So we do believe that it's in our best interest to begin the planning. I agree with the mayor that we need to have a comprehensive plan before we proceed with testing, and that's why one of the recommendations is that we suspend testing until we can complete a better plan.
Governor, what is $2 million to pay for, like some highlights of that?
The $2 million would pay for a couple things. One is really to help with a strategic plan for the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, really focus on roles and responsibilities, vision, long-term objectives. It would help us potentially reorganize the organization and make sure that we can break down the silos and really focus on the broader mission of ensuring that the people of Hawaii are warned should there be a pending disaster. And more importantly, that we can work with all levels of government, federal, state, and county, to ensure that our community and the government's response can be coordinated to reduce the impact on the public. So that's the first ask. The second ask is really about supporting all the work that needs to be done to complete the comprehensive chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear annex to our catastrophic preparedness plan. You know, there will be technical work required. We will definitely need to engage the federal government in that conversation, as well as prepare necessary studies and guidelines for what the plan should include. The third ask is really about public engagement, a public information campaign. One of the big lessons learned, I think, from this event was the fact that although we had made efforts to engage the public in preparedness, we were not successful. Too many people in our community did not know what the action step should be, and there were many questions that were generated from the false alert.
How did this fall in line, though, with what Senator Schatz is trying to do with having the federal government take over the role of alert?
You know, we are committed to having the best emergency preparedness plan and the best emergency warning system that we can. We would welcome participation from the federal government. We know that there is a lot that goes into a warning system. If you look at the report, the general did try to encompass what is required at the federal, state, county levels for the warning activity. But what's really not focused there is really what action is required after. So we would want to make sure that we have a comprehensive warning program, that everybody is clear about who can initiate alerts, and I think most importantly, that the follow-on activity, whether it be federal, state, or county levels, can do the best on behalf of the people of Hawaii.
So that if FEMA says, well, they're going to do this from now on when it comes to the missile alerts, then...
Certainly they are involved today with the missile alert, and you know, we definitely are committed to working with them should they decide that that should be their responsibility.
Your plan can still work around that.
Absolutely. You know, our plan encompasses all hazards, and we currently are responsible with the counties for natural disasters, right? Hurricanes, tsunami alerts, storm warnings, and that. So, as I said, our citizens deserve a comprehensive system that alerts and warns the public of a pending disaster, and more importantly, that can direct activities and actions that's required to keep our community safe.
You mentioned the $2 million. What does it cover? All these recommendations that were made from this report, how much would it cost for all of these, and also more importantly, how long will all that take?
Well, certainly some of the recommendations are longer term, so you'll see one of the items identified was the fact that we only have one deep draft harbor. And clearly from a total state preparedness resiliency program, we would need to have a second deep draft harbor so that we can continue importation of goods. You know, that is a very expensive undertaking. And so the report identifies that as a long-term objective, but we don't have a cost estimate for that. So there are a number of things that are long-term. There are a number of things that are purely within the scope of existing activities, and it really is about prioritizing existing resources and activities that the agency is currently doing, and other state agencies. So not everything in the report would require funding. We do believe that the $2 million or so really accelerates our preparedness activities and will prepare us and really accelerate the improvement that I think that our community deserves.
So with that $2 million in funding, to get all of these in place, how long will it take for that money to go into effect?
Well, I think it's a couple things. First and foremost, it really is about hiring a leader. So we are in the process. Haima had been advertising for a new administrator. We have accepted applications. Hopefully in the next few days we can complete the interview and hiring process. Second activity is really about a strategic plan and talking about goals and missions and looking at whether we might need to reconfigure or restructure the agency. You know, I do believe that that can be done in a couple of months, and it would be something that would allow us to take immediate action. And I think longer term, obviously, there are a number of things that would take a much longer time to complete. So I think those things that we've identified for the immediate request are things that we believe can be done in the next 12 months or so. he has a current job, but
Mayor, you talked about capacity, technological capacity.
We've been bringing you the governor's office news conference about General Harrow's report, and we've just got about a minute or so left in the show. I'm here with Bill Dorman and Catherine Cruz. What kind of impressions did that leave you with, Bill?
Reconfigure the agency, long-term plans, talk of a deep draft harbor. Boy, that's a longer-term project. So this is going to be a long-involved process. It's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah, deep draft harbor, you're talking Army Corps of Engineers, a long time in the permitting process, and lots of money.
I thought there was a lot of emphasis on a breakdown of leadership at HIEMA, not so much acknowledgement of a breakdown of leadership at the governor's office. There was, seemed to me, an effort to contain it and get it away from the governor's door.
And talk about reconfiguring that agency in terms of seeing what exactly that is like. He also did attach a timeline to that of being able to do that within a year.
Yeah, so we'll see what comes out of the legislature, if they will come up with the money to do what we need to do going forward.
And as Harry Kim just reminded us, he speaks his mind, so it's going to be interesting to see what he has to say, because he's known for his candor, right?
And public input, you've got to think, is going to be a part of this process as it continues to go forward. Because
sure,
if there's one lesson that they were able to take away, that they don't have that communication piece of this.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, looking at a federal regulation that prohibits tip sharing with the so-called back-of-the-house restaurant workers.
We always like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Show for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And we thank our news director, Bill Dorman, for joining us. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.